Good evening, everyone. I'm joined here with Ellen Brown. She's the author of The Web of Debt. It's nice having you on the show. So when did this book come out?
It first came out the summer of 2007 when the two Bear Stearns hedge funds collapsed. I rushed it into print. And then it's now in its fifth edition. So its current edition came out in January of this year, 2012.
So where do you kind of, with the book, you do have the chapters listed on your website?
I have some of them, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the first one is the lessons from the Wizard of Oz. Could you explain what that means?
I based the whole book on the Wizard of Oz as a theme, because it turns out that the Wizard of Oz was written as a monetary allegory in the 1890s. And it's something I think we should be repeating today. There was a big populist money reform movement then. The money supply had radically shrunk after the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln had issued greenbacks, or government issued money, in order to beat the debt trap of the British and New York bankers who were trying to trapped the North into debt with usurious interest rates. So he just issued his own money, and that worked very well. And the North won the war, and a lot of expansion went on during that period. But after the war, of course, he was assassinated, and they withdrew that program. They said it was just an emergency measure for the war. And on top of that, in 1873, silver was demonetized. Before that, silver and gold could back the currency, but after that, only gold. So that radically shrunk the money supply. So, and at that time, banks were able to call their loans at will. If they didn't have the backing for the loans, they would just say, pay up now. And of course, all these farmers who had taken out loans on their farms or whatever didn't have the money, and so they were losing their farms right and left. The farmers were losing their farms, the workers were losing their jobs. So in The Wizard of Oz, the workers were represented by the Tin Man, who in the actual book, The Wizard of Oz, which was published in 1900, the Tin Man he was a woodsman, and he had fallen in love with a young girl, and a witch had put a spell on him so that he would, to keep them apart, so that the harder he worked, the more he chopped off parts of his own body. And in the end, he chopped out his own heart, so he didn't care about this girl anymore. And that was the plot of the story. He wanted his heart back. And the scarecrow. But, you know, it represented the worker who, the harder they worked, the more they got into debt. And so the more they were also cutting off the blood flow to their own, to the economy, or to their own possessions or whatever. The scarecrow represented the farmers, who were supposedly not so bright, but in fact it was the farmers who understood what was really going on with the whole money situation. And in that Wizard of Oz, the scarecrow is the one that always figures everything out, even though he thinks he's the one without a brain. And there's just a whole lot of symbolism in the book, but it gave me a hook to write on this subject. That the whole point of the book is that virtually all of our money is now created by banks in the form of loans, rather than being created by the government, as most people think. And so actually 40% of everything we buy is interest. So we're paying this huge tribute to the financial sector, which has grown exponentially. I think it's up to 40% of the economy now, and which we don't have to pay.
What was the percentage at the time the Federal Reserve was created?
The percentage of what?
That the financial sector took up of our economy.
I don't actually know, but it's definitely grown a lot. I mean, it wasn't long ago. It was like a decade ago. It was only something like 10 or 15%.
So that was all recent. That dramatic increase was in the last decade. Did it mostly happen in the recent financial crisis and the bailouts?
Well, it was in the 1990s that all the rules were changed. You know, the banks were complaining that they were losing market share, and the banks are in this unique position that they can actually get legislation changed just so that they could improve their market share. So all the rules were relaxed, and that was when Glass-Steagall was withdrawn. You know, Glass-Steagall was put in place in the 1930s so that banks that took deposits could not speculate with the money. They couldn't. You had to separate speculative banking or investment banking, where you're investing in different things, from depository banking, where you're supposed to be just keeping people's money for safekeeping and lending it out. But, you know, basic, you keep the loans, not all this. I mean, there were many rule changes, one of which was the banks were allowed to sell their loans off to investors. And that's what created this whole housing boom and bust, and basically the banking crisis of 2008 was sort of hinged on all that. So they opened up the rules, and the banks were doing all sorts of things, supposedly policing themselves, but now we've seen that that doesn't work.
So the second chapter, which is also a reference to The Wizard of Oz, is Behind the Curtain, the Federal Reserve and the Federal Debt.
Alan Greenspan, actually, more than Ben Bernanke, Alan Greenspan was sort of the consummate wizard. You know, he was this little man behind the curtain turning knobs and dials, and he's very mysterious. So he would come across as being the great wizard. But in fact, we've seen now, I mean, he's admitted himself that he didn't really know what he was doing. I mean, he didn't anticipate that things would turn out the way they did. They all collapsed. So it was he who liberalized the rules, lifted the rules. But of course, the Federal Reserve wasn't even instituted until 13 years after The Wizard of Oz was written. And obviously, Alan Greenspan wasn't even born yet. But the imagery is so, it was almost prescient, you know, it was almost, in the 1890s, what it was an image of was that, in 1896, I think, oh, I've forgotten, who's the president who's on the...
McKinley?
Yeah, McKinley, right, was president. And he actually had an advisor who people said were pulling his strings. And so that was, you know, it was just known in the news. It was a typical bit of news of the day, rather like Bush and... You know, his advisor, his name also just escaped me. But so it was all sorts of politics of the day. But that's the way it still works, that it's actually the bankers who are pulling the strings of the president.
So you get into how the Federal Reserve was set up. I'm interested in, you're familiar with The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffith. Do you agree mostly with his theory on the Federal Reserve, or do you have any disagreements?
I thought that was a great book. He's got, you know, some real interesting information in there, and I did cite him quite a bit. But I disagree with his solution. His solution is...
His work, his research on the Federal Reserve is absolutely correct, but you disagree with what he advocates.
Right, his expose of the Fed is great, yeah.
So what about his solutions that you disagree with? I think, no, isn't he? He's an Austrian economist.
Yeah. Well, he would go back to gold, which I don't think works. I mean, it never did work. That was actually the problem. That if you use real gold, in other words, that what he's recommending is you use only gold and you don't have any sort of fractional reserve lending or. You know, the way it is today, that the banks, or the way it was in the 19th century, banks could lend up to 10 times as many notes as they had gold, because people only came for their gold 10% of the time, and they had that all figured out. So they were basically lending the same gold many times over. So he's saying it should just be one unit of gold. I mean, the gold can only be, it either belongs to you or somebody's borrowed it, but it's, you know, it can't be both places at once. But we can see the result just by looking at the crisis in Europe right now. they did have basically what was a gold system, in the sense that there were only so many euros out there and you couldn't get any more. But all loans come at interest, and all money is actually originally, bank loans are just issued on the books. So that's money issued on the books. And more money is always owed back to the bankers than they put out there. If you're talking 20 years, then you pay back twice as much as the bank puts out there. So you have this exponential growth of the debt, and you don't have any growth of the money supply.
Goes back thousands of years. You really talk about the history of banking and usury since ancient times throughout the Middle Ages in Europe.
Yeah, I'm writing a book now on public banking, which goes into that more. I mean, it's like an onion. There's layer upon layer upon layer. It never stops. All the things that we weren't told, you almost have to re-educate yourself in the whole history of what we're doing here.
So could you talk more? I had Mark Armstrong of the Public Banking Institute on this show recently. And I think, were you a speaker at one of their events?
Yeah, we just had our Public Banking Institute conference in Philadelphia, and I was a speaker.
So public banking, what it would do is it would eliminate a lot of the debt and usury, so it would make it easier. Much easier for people who want to start up a small business, for instance, and it would sort of centralize. There's talk about whether, like in China, the banking is very centralized, but what I think the Public Banking Institute sort of advocates is sort of each state having their own public bank.
Right, that's what we do advocate, because, I mean, it would be great if we could change the problem at the federal level, but it's so hard. They don't get anything done. It seems like both parties, or particularly the Republicans right now, are bent on stopping anything that the Democrats want to do. And I'm sure when the roles change, it'll be the same the other way around. So we feel that there's a lot more leverage and opportunity at the state level. And we have a state model, which is the Bank of North Dakota. It's the only state that escaped the credit crisis, and they're the only state that has their own state-owned bank. And so I've written extensively on that, and that's on our website, the Public Banking Institute website. And now we're even looking at the county and city levels, which are even more open to grassroots local action. That some counties are run by like three commissioners, so you could get three guys together over lunch, and they could decide to do a bank, and it would be a done deal.
Yeah, the thing is, it's basically impossible to get someone decent elected to president or on a national level. But getting someone elected to county commissioner, especially in a rural county, maybe like where I am in LA County, would be more difficult, but in a rural county, as a smaller population, it's actually not that difficult. The county commissioners could get together, and they could set up a public bank.
Right, and in places like, I'm from LA County too, but in places like Pennsylvania or Ohio, those local economies are really suffering. And if they see, and they're the ones that have like three commissioners that could vote and pull it off. So they could just get it into their, if they understood the concept, they could just take off and run with it. And they're actually, we are making progress there. I mean, they're actually quite interested in this idea. Particularly our idea at the moment is to have county-owned banks that would take up these abandoned, foreclosed, and blighted properties by eminent domain. These are the ones that are supposedly owned by the banks, but the bank, because of all this MERS litigation, the mortgage electronic registration systems, in the name of which 60% of homes now are now held, courts are increasingly holding that this electronic database doesn't have standing to foreclose and doesn't actually have title. So there's no title. The chain of title has been broken. So these local counties could put notice in the paper and say, we're going to take these homes allegedly owned by the banks by eminent domain. Anybody who can prove title will pay fair market value, but they're not going to be able to prove title because of this MERS problem. You know, now it's up to the homeowner to prove that there's a title problem, and the homeowners don't have any money, so the courts just go with the banks. You know, the banks have the big attorneys, and they always win. But if you put the burden on the bank has to come into court and prove that it owns this property, then the counties could get a lot of properties free and clear, and then that would be part of the capital base of a bank, and then they could use the revenues, the county revenues that they put in this bank, they could leverage them into loans the way banks do. You basically double your money when you're a bank because the deposits are still there on deposit, but at the same time you lend them out. And the way they get away with that is if the depositor comes for his money, then the bank borrows from another bank, and they can borrow from each other at 0.25% right now, the Fed funds rate. So they can borrow from each other at almost nothing. So they've got, because they have this huge network of being able to borrow from each other, then they can lend money that isn't really there, basically. lend money that really belongs to the depositor, but no problem, because if the depositor comes, they can get it.
And I know in North Dakota, don't they have some law that keeps big corporations from owning agricultural land?
Oh, I'm not aware of that, but I know they do. They do favor, they have certain projects. The Bank of North Dakota is geared toward promoting local economic things, and one of them is agriculture, one is energy.
So you have a chapter on about the real story behind the illegal alien invasion.
Yeah, well, that we're always complaining about the Latin Americans coming up here and, you know, crossing the border. But the reason they were forced out of their homes was because in the 1990s, when we had all this liberalization of the banking industry, that supposedly Mexico went bankrupt, but it was actually our banks that were about to go bankrupt because they were the creditors, the Wall Street banks. And so we bailed out the creditors. But the effect, we the taxpayers bailed out the creditors, which was Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and so forth, the big banks. And but the effect on the Mexican economy was to trash the economy. I mean, it trashed the peso, the local currency. That we persuaded them to let their currency float before that. They, in other words, allow the currency to go according to market rates rather than setting what its value was relative to the dollar. So as soon as it started to float, it was supposed to just float down to its natural level. But what happened was it just crashed, which is typically what happens. That's a very complicated subject, but I've covered that in that whole chapter. But the point was, it's our own fault that the Mexicans are starving or were starving. I understand that now they're going back the other way because conditions are better at home than they are here.
So Mexico had originally they had a state-owned bank, but it was returned back to private ownership. Did that happen at the same time? I think it was 1994 was NAFTA. That was the other thing. NAFTA, which destroyed a lot of the small farms in Mexico, but that was the big thing. You say that the state Mexico used to have a state-owned bank and it went back to private ownership.
Right. Well, that was part of because they had these loans to the IMF. The IMF does conditionalities, imposes these conditions, which are one of which is they have to sell off all their national assets, basically, including their public banks, their public transportation systems, which crippled the workers. They have to have their cheap bus service, or how are they going to get to work? And that lay off a lot of workers. You know, the typical belt-tightening austerity measures that we're having to do today, but it was even worse then when you had a loan to the IMF. It was pretty cut and dried that you had to do all that. But they wouldn't have needed this loan to the IMF except for the fact that the way their currency had been manipulated, and that was a banker issue.
So NAFTA opened up the nationalization of Mexican banks to a lot of U.S. operated banks, including Goldman Sachs.
Right. Yeah, and they actually, they bought up banks.
So the bankers, they wanted to see they sort of got two things out of it. They were able to loot Mexico's economy, but then they were able, on top of it, to get all the extra cheap labor.
Right. Yeah, and they were, I don't know that banks use labor, but
not the banks specifically, but the big corporations.
Right.
They're all tied in together.
Exactly.
Do you write at all about that planned North American Union?
No, I haven't written about it. I mean, I'm certainly aware of it. But I think it's not going to happen now. We've seen what happened with the EU. I think we've seen through it to the point where they wouldn't be able to pull it off.
Do you think you could see countries sort of opt out of the EU?
Well, Greece is either going to opt out or be forced out, I would guess. I mean, I think there's a solution to that, and I thought about writing it, but it seems to me what they should do is issue their own currency, but keep the euro. You know, the concern is if they go back to the drachma, that the same thing will happen as happened to the peso. It'll get totally devalued, and the speculators will come in and they'll trash the currency. But what they could do is keep the euros in the banks where they are and, use them in the ordinary way, and particularly use them for foreign trade the way they used to use gold. But the government should also issue drachmas for the local budget. In other words, get that economy moving again. Start paying workers and materials. They've got the workers. They've got the materials. The only thing they don't have is the money to pay them. So just print some money, the local currency, and say, this currency is good for, if you're worried about it collapsing, then do set prices or something, set it on cost plus or whatever so that the currency can't get trashed. But it seems to me that's what Argentina did when their currency collapsed. It worked brilliantly well. That's what Germany did in the 1930s. I mean, it's what Hitler did to turn the economy around, and of course, I won't go into that.
It is kind of very taboo subject, but it is true that the reason that Germany's economy is so good under Hitler because they got rid of usury into the public banking.
Yeah, well, you wonder why all those good Germans. I mean, I know Germans are perfectly normal, good people. How could they follow that form of dictator he's been characterized as? I mean, I think his personality did change, but in the early 30s, the reason they all marched in lockstep behind him was that he totally turned the economy around, and he did it by issuing a local currency. I mean, they were basically IOUs or warrants. He just issued, money and paid for people, but paid for work and materials. And they did all kinds of building. They got the highways going. The Autobahn was put in, and it was all done with this currency printed by the government.
And the same is with China.
China and Japan, many countries, Korea, they've all done that. But they don't talk about it the way, Libya talked about it, and Libya got crushed. They're better. Japan particularly, I think, has learned their lesson. They did the same thing in the 30s, and Japan and Germany had to be brought down, and they were brought down. But the Japanese are still doing it, but in a very discreet way. I'm just writing about that now. So it's not obvious that that's what they're doing.
So talking about the European economic crisis, you say that the Goldman Sachs instituted a coup in Europe, which they failed to do in America. I'm interested why you say they failed to do that in America. I mean, they got their massive bailout.
Well, what I was trying to say, I think maybe I didn't. I did get a fair amount of flack on that. What I meant to say was it was an uphill battle. He had to fall on his knees, and Henry Paulson and plead and say that the whole economy was going to collapse. And then there was, you know, Congress went, then it was only a temporary thing. Congress didn't put in a permanent bailout under any conditions. But in Europe, there's no pleading. There's no, we don't even hear about the negotiations. It's just like assumed that you have to please the creditors and whatever it takes. So in Europe, it just happened bang, 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 and they just got what they got their way. And now that what I was writing about was the European stability mechanism, which is an agreement that's supposed to go into place in July, that that all the countries will agree to cough up whatever money is needed to bail out, supposedly to bail out the countries, but that means bailing out the banks. It's the banks that are on the hook for these loans. The banks are the creditors.
So the Wall Street interest rates are, the interest rate swaps are what's really bankrupting the local governments.
Right, uh-huh. The swaps are, it was actually a huge scam. I mean, our whole system is, if you look at it, it's so obviously fraudulent, and yet it's very difficult to get out of. The argument of the banks is, well, a deal's a deal. You signed on the dotted line, and it's a contract. But it's their man, Ben Bernanke, who controlled the whole thing. I mean, if you've got, it's like, it just reminds me of Alice in Wonderland, where the queen gets to make the rules, and then she says, okay, you broke the rules. Off with her head, that kind of thing. So what happened in that case was that Goldman Sachs and the Wall Street investment advisors came to these cities, and basically people not real, like cities in the South that where they're not real savvy about investing, and so they take the word of their investment advisor, who says, well, you're going to need to protect your interest rate with some of these interest rate swaps, which are, the deal was, if the it protected against going up, you know, at that time they were 5%. So you buy this thing, and that will, if it goes to 10%, then the bank will absorb the difference. But what happened was it went to 1%. And so it was the cities that had to absorb the difference. So they wind up paying all this money to Wall Street that they don't need to be paying when interest rates are ridiculously low. And meanwhile, they can't get, because interest rates are so low, they're not getting the taxes and the return on their investment, so they don't have the money to pay this excess. So, and the reason interest rates went so low was that Ben Bernanke, their man in the Federal Reserve, stepped in and dropped the interest rates very low to protect the banks, not to protect the cities and states. I mean, it screwed the cities and states, if I can say that on radio.
You also write about the healthcare crisis was also tied into this.
What was the link? I'm not sure what you're referring to.
You know what? I can't find the exact article, but you talk about
I've
how...
I've definitely written on it, that we can solve
it. Another one about how Obamacare is basically a scam to subsidize the insurance companies. I think it's that one.
Oh, right. There's no way. Well, I'll just tell you my personal experience. I live with my mother, and she's been in the hospital 3 times in the last year. First, she broke her hip. She was in there for 4 days. The bill was $113,000 in the hospital. That was the hospital bill. Then she fractured her pelvic bones, and the bill was... I'm not sure what the bill was there. But anyway, this last time she was in, she just went in because she didn't feel good. And they gave her antibiotics and stuff. She was, again, it was 4 days. It was $53,000. Now, she's just a typical elderly woman, 92, who, if we have to pay that for every person that makes it to 90, they're in the hospital several times before they pass away. There's no way we can afford that. And if you look at other countries, like in England, of course, it's socialized medicine, but we could do the exact same medicine that they're doing for $1 trillion for the whole country. But the difference is that we're paying way more for all these tests and drugs, and everything's more expensive here because they can jack the prices up to anything they want.
So you are in favor of us of some kind of socialized medicine? I noticed you write about it.
Well, I would be in favor of
social credit.
I'd be in favor of the single payer idea, where it's basically Medicare for all. So you still have your private doctors and private hospitals and so forth, but it's just it's like one insurer, and we're all joined in this one insurance plan, which is a public insurance plan. You don't have to have it. You could have your own private insurance, but it should cover everybody, or everybody should have the option of having that one.
So it'd be different than, isn't how Obamacare works. Obamacare is not single payer. It's more of isn't a government subsidy on the private health insurance companies.
Right, and it's you're forced to take some sort of private insurance, and it's so it's a big burden on all these 30-year-olds who are perfectly healthy, but they don't have a job because of the downturn, which is the fault of the banks in the first place. You know, the banks and the insurance companies are basically the same thing. They all have their insurance departments. So it's their fault that these young people are out of a job, and now they want to force these young people to buy this very expensive insurance to pay for the older people, when if there was really a free market, which is what everybody seems to want, you should have the choice to not get insurance. Why not allow people to take that risk if they want to? I never had insurance until recently.
So back to more sort of economic solutions. You talk about the Tobin tax, as opposed to the value-added tax, the VAT.
Right, the Tobin tax. Well, its derivatives is what's killing the global economy, really. It's because of derivatives that it's the interest rate that's killing Greece, not the debt. Their interest rate is 18%. At 18%, debt doubles in under 4 years. So that's why their debt has shot up, because of this interest. Now, and what has allowed the speculators to drive up the interest rates is derivatives. So if you got rid of the whole derivative thing, if you have a Tobin tax, which is a tax on financial trades, then that would kill the derivatives market. You know, these high-frequency program traders come in, they're doing millions of trades a minute on these machines that are just skimming profits off the trades of real people, real investors who are actually looking at the corporation and deciding if it's a good business and if they want to own it and so forth. The computers come in there and they just skim profits off it, and they can come in and bring down a currency. So if you put a tax on every trade, it would kill the speculators, because they're doing, you know, a million trades a minute, that's going to be a heavy tax. But if it's 1%, for normal people, we don't buy a stock more than even if you're in there actively trading, it's probably not more than every couple of weeks or so. You've got to find a good stock and decide it's, read all about it and decide if you really want to do it and watch it for a while. I mean, most people don't buy a stock more than probably once a year. I don't know what even people that are in the market do. But the thing is, it wouldn't hurt us. It would hurt the speculators, and it would pretty much kill their business, which would be a good plus. It would be hugely lucrative for the government to get all this tax.
Now, Tobin tax has been implemented.
There's talk of implementing them. I don't know. It used to be that you couldn't speculate. It used to be illegal to do the types of things they do now.
So when was it legalized?
I think it was under Greenspan, and it was 1990-something, 92 maybe, 94.
Are you talking about the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act?
No, it was another issue. It used to be that this was considered a form of gambling, and they did have a tax on it, and you couldn't do it with, bankers couldn't do it.
So you write more about public sector banks. Say that you say from black sheep to global leaders,
and you get really get more into it. So the two largest banks by market capitalization are the IBC and the China Construction Bank.
Right.
And the largest bank by deposits is the Japan Post Bank. And right. The largest bank by assets is the Royal Bank of Scotland, which has now been nationalized. And the world's largest development bank is the BNDES in Brazil.
Right. 40% of banks globally are now publicly owned. And these are largely in the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, which have 40% of the global population. And those are also the countries that escaped the credit crisis. And this was largely because, or certainly one factor, was that they have a very strong public banking sector. The public banks are countercyclical. When other banks are afraid to lend because they're afraid they can't find good borrowers, or they're afraid of market conditions, or they don't have the capital base, the public banks tend, that's when they get even more busy lending. They step in and lend and lend and lend and get the economy going again because they're backed by the government and they have a mandate to serve the public interest.
So that's part of the reason we talked about China. Brazil's another country which has been doing, which also escaped the recent economic crisis.
Right, and that was there. What happened was Lula, President Lula, in the 90s, Brazil was the largest debtor in the world. And in 1991, President Lula was elected. He was, I think he was an auto worker. I mean, he definitely was a man of the people. And he just took over this big development bank, the BNDES, which was a publicly owned bank, and started making loans to everything in sight. No derivatives. He didn't allow any kind of speculation, but he made loans to any business that was productive, you know, that roads and bridges and housing and all sorts of seaway products, etc. And just turned the economy around very quickly. So there was one line that I quoted. He said, so now they're a creditor of the IMF. The IMF owes them money. And he said, don't you think it's very chic that the IMF owes us money, or that we're a creditor of the IMF?
And that is, I just got to say, it's really remarkable. I mean, yeah. I understand hardly anyone is talking about this. It goes back to the bankers, or the media is also beholden to the bankers. You're never going to hear about it in the media. But it's amazing how so many of our economic problems could be solved by public banks.
Yeah, I know. I think that you're hearing about it a little more. I mean, mostly on the internet, but that's what we do at the Public Banking Institute.
Are you an official board member of the Public Banking Institute?
Yeah, I'm the president, actually.
I thought it was Mark Armstrong.
No, he's an executive director.
Okay, I didn't know that. I had him on recently.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it sort of grew out of my writing. I had learned that that North Dakota was the only state that had its own bank in the fall of 2008 after the Lehman Brothers collapse. And so I started speaking about that and writing about it. And I got flooded with email, and I couldn't handle all the emails. So somebody suggested that I start a Google group, which I did. And for the next couple of years, we had a really active Google group with several hundred members. And after we felt we had all the issues nailed down, we decided it was time to do something. So we formed an institute. It's nonprofit. We're all just volunteers, but we've had actually quite a bit of impact. We've got 18 states now that have introduced bills of one sort or another for publicly owned banks. And now we're working on the counties and the cities.
That's good to hear about some kind of success.
Yeah, that's our whole thing. Solutions. How do we fix it? And we can fix it. the thing. We're quite convinced that there's a fairly simple solution here if we just can break through the prejudice or the conditioning, you know, that everybody has against government anything or publicly
owned. Yeah, the conditioning is that people will say, the conditioning is people say public banking is socialism, but it's quite the contrary. If anything, it will help jumpstart small entrepreneurs.
Right, that's the way it works in North Dakota. They have a booming economy, and that's all private business, and the Bank of North Dakota feeds all that. It feeds the local banks, which are private, and the banks then have the capital and the liquidity to make loans as needed. In other places, like here, California, small businesses are having a lot of trouble getting loans from banks because they don't want to take the risk. North Dakota doesn't have that problem.
Yeah, the banking system is definitely, the current private for-profit banking system makes it extremely difficult to start a small business. It's sort of why we see this sort of these big corporate monopolies, because the big corporations are tied in so much with the big banks.
Yeah, true.
So what is this most recent article is cooperative banking in the Aquarian age. Just came out several days ago.
It was actually, I was asked to write that for Alternet. So it's about the fact that things seem really bad and everybody feels like the whole economy is collapsing and there's no hope and so forth. But if you look carefully underneath, there are these little green sprouts of this whole cooperative banking movement. So that would include public banks, what are called alternative banks, and credit unions, that type of thing. So alternative banks are where either the customers own the thing, that would be a credit union, or where it's like in Japan, they have these things called keiretsu, which are the bank is actually owned by this group of businesses. So that the businesses and the banks are all the same thing. So they have their own bank, basically. So they can borrow, because they own the bank, they can borrow interest-free, basically. And a model like that in Spain is Mondragon, if you've heard of that. So those are all in the called alternative banks. And then community currencies, I mean, there are all sorts of, in Africa now, they have a whole alternative banking system that is based on telephones, where they don't need banks at all. They basically just transfer telephone minutes to each other. There are many more people that have cell phones than have bank accounts in Africa. And the banks just aren't even there. So they use their telephones as a form of money, or, you know, as a form, like kind of like a credit card.
Yeah, cooperative banks, how common are they in the United States? Could you give some examples? You do mention some of them. One of them is the One Pacific Coast Bank and the New Resource Bank in California, Oregon, and Washington.
Yeah, well, they're not real common. That's the thing. You have to look for them. But there is a movement, and that was my whole point. It's doing well. They're actually... There was a study that came out that showed that form of banking has done better in the last few years than private banks, partly because if you're the owners and you're interested, in other words, you're the employees or the creditors or the local community that's going to benefit from this, then the profits are going back to the people, you know, going back to the people who use the bank, who can then use it better. In other words, it's a self-sustaining model. Instead of having private shareholders who are only interested in their short-term profits and then they're out of there. And, you know, they have no qualms about just collapsing the cost of the share price, because they're just interested in making quick money. I mean, I'm not faulting that type of thing. I mean, I'm in the stock market myself, but that's just the way it works. You don't really have a personal interest in this thing. You're interested in watching the money go, you know, the numbers go up and down. And when you see the numbers start collapsing, then you panic and you think, oh my God, I'm going to lose my investment, and you pull your money out. So it's all kind of hot money, you know, it jumps from here to there. Whereas in the alternative bank model, it's sustainable because they're there all the time and they're supporting each other, and the profits go back to this collective that is the bank, along with its local community businesses or whatever the arrangement is.
We touched on Austrian economics and the gold standard briefly, but I've been a few people who advocate, I know, who advocate either public banking or social credit. They think that Austrian economics is kind of a scam to distract dissidents from solutions. Do you agree with that critique of Austrian economics?
Well, I don't know that they don't mean well, but to me it just is an old, obsolete model that's just not going to work. I mean, even just returning to gold. Now, who has all the gold today?
Yeah,
who has the gold? The central banks have the gold.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I think I heard somewhere that the Rockefeller, maybe forget who said it. One of the guests on my show said that the Rockefeller Foundation sponsored Ludwig von Mises to come over to the United States. That is very fascinating.
I guess Ed Griffin was sponsored by somebody too. I'm not sure, but I know people in that whole movement. Of course, they're totally well-meaning. I just don't think it'll work. Basically, it just won't work.
We're out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to add? And you can also please plug your website.
My website is webofdebt.com. I've got over 130 articles on there since 2007, and I've done over 500 interviews that are posted there in one form or another. And then we have our Public Banking Institute website, which is publicbankinginstitute.org, and it has all kinds of information on the movement and if you're interested in getting involved, how you can do that.
And were you
happening.
The founder of the Public Banking Institute?
Sorry?
Were you the founder of the Public Banking Institute?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I sort of got pushed. I got pushed from behind, but
I'd like to thank you again for being on.
Okay, thank you for having me.
That's all we have for tonight, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.